Hello. Anyone venturing online in the early years of the 21st century, but particularly the last few, who's interested in the 18th and 19th centuries will surely have stumbled across the work of Joshua Proven. Josh Proven, his history blog, Adventures in History Land, his activity with History Hack, of course, the podcast, and also Zach White's excellent podcast, latterly named The Napoleonicist, and now rebranded The Napoleonic Wars podcast, an excellent community growing there. Well, Josh is all over that sort of thing. And I've been very lucky to have him on board the Napoleonic Quarterly as well, helping out most recently, as you'll have heard, with the headline developments at the start of each episode. Long may that continue. And most recently, we've been talking to Josh about developments in the subcontinent and culminating in the siege of Seringapatam. Well, Josh is published an author. He's written two books, Wild East, The British in Japan, 1854 to 1868, and most recently, Bullock's Grain and Good Madeira, The Maratha and Jat Campaigns, 1803 to 1806, and the Emergence of an Indian Army. Josh, it's great to have you on the podcast and great to have a chance to talk to you about your work and your interest in the period.
Alex, it's always lovely to talk to you, and I absolutely adore coming back on Napoleonic Quarterly and talking to everybody about history anytime I can.
Well, I think that's what marks you out, that you are so enthusiastic about so much. I'm not quite sure how you do it, to be honest. I think there's a question that needs to be asked here about where this extraordinary motivation has come from. Did you study history at school, at university? Where did it start?
It started when I was a little boy, playing toy soldiers with my dad. And the books helped the games get better. And I always wanted to be a novelist and tell stories. And from that came Adventures in History Land. Because I wanted to practice writing, and I was doing a lot of research, and I couldn't figure out what to write because I was researching various books on various subjects for several years, and I couldn't figure out what to write. I couldn't find the story. But then I found that Adventures in History Land was taking more and more sort of my attention. The research, like publishing the stories I had found due to my, enthusiasm, my relatively unfocused but somewhat absorbent mind. And yes, from there, I came into nonfiction and people, to my endless surprise, liked what I was doing. And then I started to wonder whether I could write a book. And again, to my endless surprise, someone said, yes, we'd like to publish it.
It's not surprising at all, because I think on Adventures in History Land, it's possible to dip into any of the things that you've turned your hand to, and you tell quite a story. And that applies across the board, really. And your interests are very, very broad. I mean, they do stretch all over the place. Where did your first book, Wild East, come from? This was the British in Japan in the middle of the 19th century.
Utter accident. I was curious one day, back when Mark Simner's Victorian Wars Forum was still active, about what the British were doing in Japan. I knew that I knew, of course, about the Opium Wars, and I knew that the British had this vast empire that was built on the idea of trade, essentially. And I wondered, for some reason, I think it was something stemming from The Last Samurai, and the idea that obviously Hollywood had co-opted that story for America. I was wondering, well, what were the British doing in Japan, that why, and indeed, why was Japan not colonized the way portions of Africa, China, and India were? And someone sent me a link to something called the Bombardment of Shimonoseki, which was a military event that occurred in 1864 or 63. It's been a while since I wrote the book. But and from that, I thought, oh, how interesting. So we were doing something over there, nefarious, as usual. And I let it lie for a little bit, and then I found Ernest Satow's book. Now, Ernest Satow is this extraordinary diplomat and linguist who spent most of his life in Japan and trying to understand its history and culture. And I read his book, and I thought to myself, well, if he wrote a book, other people must have written a book. And if other people wrote about it, then I can do this. And that was where the interest in the British in Japan came from. The story of how the book got accepted is simply that I wanted to write a book. I'd gotten to the point where I decided I wanted to write a book. I submitted a list to a particular publisher, and they never got back to me.
That's outrageous.
I know, outrageous. I got a little angry, which I try not to do, but some, you know, I'm a human being.
But you can't send in gunboats to publishers. That's the problem, unfortunately.
Unfortunately not. And so I turned to Mark Simner again, who's a good friend, and he suggested his then publisher, Fonthill. And they took me up on the offer to do the British in Japan. I gave them several options, but they wanted Japan. So
yeah, well, that's really good. And I think that whole story is, I think, potentially going to be a really inspiring one for those who wonder whether they could one day find their name in print. And you know, that's a really useful story, I think, for many potential budding writers to hear. Now, you mentioned the word nefarious there when it comes to the activities of the British in the 19th century. And we've just come off the back of recording a segment for season 4 of the Napoleonic Quarterly on the siege of Seringapatam, a situation where you had some proper British expansionism going on. And it happened, and it was horrible and very successful. And I think you're a really good person to ask about your views of the British Empire, this question of light and shade that has to be applied to all history, of course. But it's a really important one. What's your sense of the debate, the current state of the debate about empire?
It's a very, very good question. I wish I had an answer. Empires are not as simple as we think they are. Empire is a useful label to put on something that has the attribute, has certain attributes, and the British one does have those attributes. Whether it was a force for, a lot of people get mired in this sort of morality debate as to whether it was a force for good or a force for evil. I am more interested in the fact that it happened and how it happened and the stories inside there. I can't say, like I said at the beginning, I wish I had an answer for the people who are and I applaud those people who are searching for some sort of answer as to the meaning of all this. Why did it happen? What does it mean for us today? I think it will take longer for me anyway to get to the bottom of that. But but as with all history, to be boringly repetitive, I suppose. As with all history, it's not simple. It's people aren't simple. And the fact that it existed is it creates an environment for evil, the evil and the good to flourish.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I think you've actually articulated better than I ever have the ambiguities that, you know, I mean, I read a little bit about Empire and about what was going on in this period, and I don't feel I have a sufficiently confident opinion to push forward loudly either way, and perhaps the Napoleonic Quarterly will help me figure out a little bit of it. But, there's the next question. How do you see the 1792 to 1815 period, asking the same question, as distinct from the much bigger picture of that much bigger story of the empire as a whole? What's your sense of the Napoleonic and the French Revolutionary Wars and how that interacted with this process of expansion that did happen during these 24 years?
Again, it's a fascinating problem, isn't it? The occurrences that took place in Central Europe did have this strange echoing effect across the world, because the stakes were laid down by nations that had a global presence or an emerging global presence. And therefore, you shouldn't escape the fact that this became a global issue, that the things that occurred on the battlefields and courts of Europe eventually spilled out in for various reasons into the rest of the world. But to answer the central question there, what's my take on feeling on the Central European Napoleonic epic? I feel that this all too often comes down to an argument about whether you think the French Revolution was evil or Napoleon was a dictator. And I have, again, I try honestly not to form a strong opinion on either matter, because once you decide to dig in, you lose the objectivity, any objectivity you might have.
Well, okay, so the whole spirit of you as a historian, I think what you're really about is the digging in, and that's what drives you. That's what enthuses you, and when you dig in, you unearth more layers of subtlety, more nuance, and it becomes very hard to make things definitive one way or the other. Well, we've got the empire out of the way, so that I didn't want to go in quite so heavy, but there we are. The next question is about your book on that 1803 to 1806 period in India. And this is the Maratha and the Jat campaign, still to come on the Napoleonic Quarterly, so maybe you shouldn't be allowed spoilers. Tell me about that book. How did that come about? And, you know, why did you choose to write about that?
This one came about again by accident. I seem to have very little control over my destiny when it comes to writing books. The fact of it was, if I remember correctly, there was another forum discussion on some platform or another where I had, Andrew Bamford, who is the editor of the Reason to Revolution series at Helion and Company, Dr. Bamford, I should say. He is very active on forums and social media and history social media, you might call it. And he, back in, it would have been probably 2016, 2017, we had an exchange where he was trying to see if anybody was interested in contributing to a sort of a collection on, at the time, Napoleonic warfare. Now, I had just done a blog series on the Waterloo campaign on Historyland. I had a lot of material that is woefully inadequate when I look back at it now, but I was quite happy with it at the time, and I thought I could turn it into perhaps a chapter in that book. So I got in touch with Andrew and I said, would you like a chapter on Waterloo or something like that? And he said that, unsurprisingly, that the market was somewhat saturated.
Surely not. I think the world could do with many, many more chapters on Waterloo.
Well, you never know, maybe in the future. But at the time, after the 2015 bicentennial, everybody was had sort of had their fill of Waterloo. But he did say he would be interested in a book about the British in India. I believe this was because in the material that I sent him to prove that I could write a coherent sentence, that included my article on Wellington in India and the siege of Seringapatam. And so it must have given him the impression that I could do something about India. And of course, I said I would be very happy to do something about India. And when I looked into it, I saw that the Maratha campaign, the Maratha War, the second, was a wonderful opportunity to explore soldiering in India, and the difficulties inherent in that. And when I got into that, I discovered many things that I never knew about not only soldiering in India, but about the course of these wars, which we all know from Sharp and Wellington's life and Wellington's biographies, but they always stop at a certain point, and that's where the Jats come in. That's the siege of Bharatpur, which is an amazing event in history which not a lot of people know about.
Well, yeah, and just to get a quick snippet of that, how would you describe, you know, how would you summarize what fighting in India was like as distinct from fighting in Europe?
It's very different. The rules are similar, but they're also specific. There was one British officer said that apart from a deep winter's campaign, nobody could conceive the difficulties of fighting in India. And I think that if you want to really understand what made the Duke of Wellington such a formidable force, especially in a place like Spain, where logistics are a nightmare and where there's no easy access to central government, and the distances are vast, then you have to look at what he went through in the Second Maratha War in the Deccan campaign, where he was so careful about his logistics, and he was so precise about needing to achieve this by this point, this by this point, this by this point, and ensuring, as the title suggests, that he had enough bullocks to get his grain to feed his troops. And the Madeira is just that all the officers seem to be carrying trunks of alcohol.
Well, yeah, well, these are all ingredients of success, clearly, all very important, yeah. Okay, so that's that book, and you know, when you look back at it now, I suppose it's not part of the core story as things stand. And I mean, you know, people like Alexander Mikhaberidze and you with this book are helping address that. Why is it, do you think, that I suppose I think I know the answer to the question of why it is that we have a core story? It's because it's focused on individuals like Wellington and Bonaparte, isn't it? And there's so much else going on all over the place that actually almost gets a little bit forgotten about. But it means that for people like you, there's plenty to dig into.
Yes, there is, yes. And like you said before, I mean, I don't like to take firm stances on whether someone was good or evil, whether a particular empire or nation is all good or all evil or something like that. But when you find your topic and you dig into it, that's where it comes alive to you. That's where you get to sift through all these amazing accounts written by real people who saw these things and did these things, and you know, it opens a lot of windows in your mind.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And also potentially Windows on your browser as well, I suspect. Well, back to the online community that we have at the moment. And as mentioned, you're very active on History Hack and with Zach White's Napoleonic Wars podcast, as it is now. There's so much to be said, so many discussions to be had at the moment. It feels a little bit like there's a bit of a flourishing of discussion about this period. And all sorts of different, I mean, you know, there are plus Age of Napoleon as well, another fantastic podcast of the period and really the you know, the big beast of them all, I guess, but all taking their individual approaches. But I think Zach is where you have a real, you know, his podcast is one where you have a real community developing. I see, you know, Age of Napoleon as being an exceptionally brilliant, very long audio book, and Napoleonic Quarterly is sort of a project of its own. It's a rather protracted journey, which I'm just over 25% of the way through, and rather enjoying every step of the way. But for someone like you, you can contribute to this online conversation all over the place. There is an awful lot to be said.
There's a lot to be said. Yes, I remember commenting somewhere back during one of the endless lockdowns, that it shows the power and the popularity of podcasts. People are starting to take them seriously, especially historical ones. This is the new way people are getting the historical information. First of all, I mean, you would have people reading books, but then TV documentaries came along, and now podcasts are one of the main ways people get their historical information, how people inform themselves. If they want to know more about a subject that they feel is very important, such as, say, the British in India, they might say, well, what podcasts are out there? And of course, they might find William Dalrymple and William Dalrymple's new podcast on Empire, for instance, and multiple other places that would inform them. And you can listen to it while you're driving in the background, while you're doing many things. It's a very flexible way of interacting with history.
Well, I won't ask you to choose between books and podcasting and all those discussions, because, you know, they are linked to each other. But how do you see things developing for you in the coming years? What projects do you want to take forwards that are coming up for you?
I'm working on a book right now with Helion, and I'm also contracted for another one beyond that. So I'm sticking certain. I'm not leaving military history for the foreseeable future. That's certain. It is something I understand, although in a way I do question sometimes why war. But
oh, what do you? Yes, I think I know what you mean. But that is a discussion all of its own, isn't it? As to, and Charles Esdale answers it very well by talking about the idea that war, though horrible, is fascinating in a grim sort of way. There is this sort of, you know, if it's happening, then, I mean, we see it in the war in Ukraine at the moment. It is interesting that the Ukrainians are flying low, for example, and there's a lot to be said and discussed about a struggle that clearly matters, not just for Europe, but for the whole world. And it was the case in, you know, well, all sorts of wars are important within their particular contexts. And in this period, 1792 to 1815, so much is going on. It's pretty appalling in many ways, but it's certainly fascinating.
It is. I mean, I the only way I describe it at the second, and I don't know if one day I'll just have enough of reading about and telling people how to kill people in the most organized fashion and in the most effective way. But that day has not yet come, because to me, military history and the history of violence and combat and things is essentially a car crash that I have seen. And having seen it, I need to understand why it happened and how it happened. And in a way, there's some sort of soft thing behind it all, that maybe if I write about it and I can present the fact that these are terrible events that fascinate us, but they are nevertheless terrible, that maybe in some small way people can come to the realization I came to when I was writing about Waterloo in 2015, that war is a terrible, terrible thing. And you know, it's a disaster, and it would be lovely. I don't think they will stop, but it would be lovely if they would.
Indeed. And Wellington himself had something to say about war in the immediate aftermath of Waterloo. So maybe just a quick question. Are you allowed to say what your next book's going to be about? Can you tell us that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the cat is sort of out of the bag, because I was at Derby this summer talking about the subject itself at the Helion conference, which was the first time I got to do one of those. And it was an amazing experience. Again, to my surprise, people asked me to go and talk in person, and to my sort of astonishment, people liked it. But the next book, which if I'm a good boy and I do put the work in, will be appearing some point, I think late next year, is going to be about the siege of Pensacola during the American Revolution, and therefore we're focusing on the Spanish in the American Revolution.
So there you are, zipping off to another bit of history, which rather, you know, that's the Josh Proven approach, isn't it? You can pick things up and run with them, and that's fantastic. So do keep it going.
Sure, oh, I will, because the other thing I can hopefully tell you, which I still can't quite believe. Because one of the things that one of my ambitions was not only to do military history, but a bit of popular history as well, and try and break into a bigger market, is that I'm writing a book, not a book, I'm writing a chapter for Ian Dale's Kings and Queens collection. And my chapter is Henry VI.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's fantastic. That'd be great. Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. I look forward to reading that. Yeah, that sounds like good fun. Yes, somewhat removed from this period again. But actually, I bet there's a few interesting parallels that will strike you as you write that. Yeah. Okay, Josh, thank you very much. Thank you, of course, as well for your contributions to the Napoleonic Quarterly, not least the headline developments, which have been livening up season 4, and long, long may they continue, fingers crossed. But it's very much appreciated. It's great talking to you.
Great talking to you too, Alex. Thank you for having me.